Hey, it's Millie, and welcome to the Generalist World podcast. This is a show where I interview people from the Generalist World community, and we talk things like the future of work, careers, predictions, their hot takes, and really understand what their squealy careers have looked like. So if you're a generalist who feels like they're living in a specialized world, this is the podcast for you.
Well, Madda, it's so great to have you on the GW podcast. There is lots of threads that I think we can kind of follow today. But if someone hasn't met you before, if this is the first time they're coming across you, why might they like to tune into this episode? What do you think might be some of the threads we kind of chew on today?
I think what they might enjoy hearing is that I'm somebody who has spent her entire career in techs and in startups and scale-ups, which usually gets people kind of like itching for more information. And that I'm also somebody who is a sustainability and AI strategist, which very often those two concepts, they don't really, you know, they ask questions and they raise questions about it. Like, well, how does that work and why would that work? And I think that kind of creates, at least in my networking events, that creates a lot of very interesting conversations.
What is the best and the worst things that you've spent your whole career in tech? And when you look back at that arc, what's the best thing and what's the worst thing?
The best thing is opportunities. The best thing is kind of having the space to try a variety of things, wear multiple hats, especially in startups, you know, up to like 20, 30, 50 people, you are a variety of things. So then the learning curve is really exciting, very rewarding. You get to build a lot of things from scratch. The worst thing is that sometimes bro culture can get very intense, and sometimes, yeah, it takes a little bit of space. And I think kind of like in time, as you get more experience, you can actually kind of step back and be like, ah, I am not the problem. This is a toxic culture. And what do I want to do about it?
Yes. Steps. And when you think back to your career arc, can you tell us the kind of shape that you have followed?
I actually had a conversation recently with somebody on this, and I realized that it's very much a squiggle. It's very much, you know, when you're kind of talking for a long time on a phone with a friend and you're doodling, and I end up doing like a lot of round kind of shapes, but they're all interconnected. I think that's how my career looks like. So I'm somebody who started in comms. So I started my career basically doing communication strategy, PR, social media, in the era of when social media was a very new, very, you know, mysterious thing, when Facebook ads were not a thing, for example, they were just popping up. And then I transitioned towards, you know, event management and kind of like the bigger umbrella of how do we place people in media, how do we do press conferences, how do we talk with TV and radio and so on. And then very early on, I felt the urge and the desire to get closer to how the business is being done. So then I transitioned towards a role in between, a commercial role where basically I would do some of the comms. So no, I would redesign the website, but I would also get in the partnership conversations that I would have on how do we get more participants in the business forum that we were organizing. So I spent some time working in global mobility, where basically you kind of look at the gaps that a country has. This is where I used to live in Norway at some point, and you look at talents that are on the market, and then we were trying to see what bridges can we build together. And then after that, the kind of the squiggle goes around a bit more, and I decided that I want to go really towards expansion, go-to-market strategies, and that's when I transitioned towards tech in a more, maybe more serious way, let's say, and that's because the role itself was very techy. So I worked for a travel startup where I literally took the business model from market to market to market and spent 80% of my time traveling for a few years, which was incredibly exciting, but also very chaotic. And talking about, you know, building things from scratch while being on the road all the time, it takes something out of you, but it also gives you a lot. And then a bit after that, I took some time off, which I am a big fan of kind of taking some time to reconnect with yourself after years of working. And I transitioned towards the EV space. And that's where I did first a strategy role. And then I basically saw an opportunity to pivot towards sustainability, initially ESG, because that was an opportunity that I saw in the organization, and then sustainability, corporate sustainability. So carbon footprint, life cycle assessments, how do we, you know, reduce our carbon footprint and how do we consume less resources while still keeping the bottom line. And then after 7 years of that, I took another career break, and I'm now in this beautiful intersection of sustainability and AI. You know, what is sustainable AI to begin with? Can that even exist? What is the social part of AI? What is the governance part of AI? And the squiggle continues. So I find myself now very drawn to this space of how do we apply AI in a responsible and efficient and a kind of ethical way. But I definitely have my other foot still in corporate sustainability.
Ooh, I didn't realize that you had spent so many years on the road. I had a very similar background. In my 20s, I was working for this, well, I was a tour guide for my early start of my 20s, and then I moved more into managing the tours and then creating the tours. And I was just living out of a backpack on the road for literally years. And I remember I got to like maybe 26 or 27 years old and thinking, all I want is a set of drawers. I just want a set of drawers to be able to put my stuff in. And it like naturally, really naturally came to an obvious close that I was like, I'm so ready for a familiar roof.
Yeah. Also, I wanted to be there, you know, for random friend anniversary drinks. And I wanted to be able to go over on a random Sunday for coffee. And actually, our careers in that way are quite parallel, because I also worked with guides and I also helped them create their tours. And we still connect, the company still exists, they connect travelers with local hosts. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of human interaction, a lot of like curating the experiences together. And then, you know, I would come back home and spend a week in one spot and then go over and over again.
Yeah, there's always a cost of whatever you're doing, right? So the cost, it's like, oh, well, the benefit is that we get to travel the world, we get to be paid for it, it's amazing. And there's a cost that you're missing out on your friends' birthdays and you can't go to coffee on a Sunday and things like this. There's a few really important threads I want to touch on. One is around taking time off. Why is this so taboo that we are like, no, it's a bad thing, you're getting behind. All of these things come to mind, this guilt of taking time mm-hmm. off. What is your take? What's your perspective on the importance of taking time off?
You know, you said that we're going to talk for around half an hour today. I fear we might be here for hours because I have very strong opinions on this. So I think it really boils down to work identity and how in our generation, particularly starting with millennials here, work identity has been very, very entangled and sometimes overlapped with self-identity. So then in this era, you know, if we just put kind of like some of the blocks that have happened in our generation, you know, we've been told work really, really hard and everything will work out. Do the studies, get the job, things are going to work out for you. And then for some of us, that comes also with the sacrifices that come from our families. You know, for a lot of us, it's also kind of like the first degree of the family or the first kind of like higher education and masters or so on. So it comes with a lot of pressure as well, right? We have done everything that we needed to do so that you, the child, will then go and have a successful life. So for a lot of us, we stepped into this role of work, whatever work meant for us, and especially in tech where, you know, there is this narrative of the family together, the pizza Friday parties, we're in this no matter what, you know, play hard and work hard in the same time. And so then the overlap of identity, I think, is quite severe in our generation. And we see it now shifting quite a bit with Gen Z, where that's a bit of a disappointment that has come and during their generation. So then their need has diminished there. So then they have a lot of things going outside of work. So I think the taboo is really coming from there. It comes from an inability to pause that comes from the pressure that we picked up, some of that being self-pressure, some of that being pressure that was put on us. And then the more entangled you are in that identity, the harder it is to step back, because we need distance to see things, right? The power of hindsight is particularly useful and strong because we can use it to look at the past. But if when you're in the middle of things, we're in the thick of things, I think it's very, very difficult to step away. So then that, together with the really intense or fast rhythm of how things move in tech, right? You blink twice and the technology has shifted already. You go away for a week and you come back to hundreds or thousands of emails. So then there's this pull and push in how needed you need to be to move forward, but how much that takes out of you in order to stay and keep doing the same thing. So there's very little left for the self. And I'll pause here because I can go on a longer story, but I think that the taboo is really coming from there of, you know, on one hand, identifying that, hey, my work is such a big part of me, and then feeling that we worked so hard to get to where we did, so then stepping away feels like a risk. And I think also we don't have enough people around us that do it. Or maybe now it's shifting a bit, but I think, you know, if I think in my 20s, there were definitely not people around me that were taking time off. Where do you stand?
Yeah, it deeply resonates. And in fact, I'm going to send you after this the draft of an essay that I'm publishing this Friday, and I'm calling it Post-Productivity. And it's this sense that I'm getting that AI is getting so good, like spooky, mm-hmm. so good. My productivity in some ways is through the roof, and in other ways I feel like I cannot simply keep up because there's so much more I can do. And the essay is around, let's say there's a future, and that future is not mm-hmm. so far away, where the productivity is actually mastered, where we cannot beat AI at the productivity. And because we are so entangled, as you say, in this work identity, what happens when people haven't understood or haven't come to know themselves, to know what is their worth outside of work, what is their identity outside of their job title? And I think we're going to have I don't like the word crisis, but a crisis of sorts, where A, we're going to have a lot of people out of work, and B, we're going to have a lot of people who are questioning, what is my identity in this post-productivity world?
I can see that. I can see that. I'm sure you've come across this recent study from Harvard that basically says the more productive we become with AI, the more work we add to our plates.
Interesting. I haven't. I'll have to look that up.
I'm happy to share it with you. So in a way, you know, mastering productivity, whatever that means to all of us, mm-hmm. it seems that up to this point, cognitively, what it actually does to us is that it, in a way, it doesn't let us stop. Right? Because the jobs keep on coming, the tasks keep on adding up. And with the promise of productivity through AI, and the more we use it, the more we can see how we can kind of shave off minutes and hours from the time that we would spend on it, and the fuller our plate gets. So I could totally see that identity crisis happening. And to be honest, I would say that I already see it in around me, in my peers, people who have worked incredibly hard to get to like a position of seniority in their companies. And in a way, you know, I'm sure you've had this conversation about the golden cuff where you've made it. It's not necessarily feeding into you. You don't necessarily see the impact maybe, but you've made it up to there, and it's been so difficult and it's been so much work. So stepping back feels like such a risk. And if that's what you've known, and because you've given so much of yourself to get there, which I completely respect and have done myself, you know, what is the point of like stepping away from that? Because who am I outside of that particular status that I've chased and created for myself? So yeah, I think we're also going to go through a bit of a crumbling of what status actually means, but also where else do we get our validation and reward from?
Yes. You're right, we could continue speaking about just this thread all day.
Exactly.
I wonder if you could give folks one or two kind of tangible pieces of advice if they are at that point where they're thinking, I need a break and I'm scared. I need a break and I simply can't take it because of X, Y, Z. Is there something you learned from taking your breaks that you could share with people?
I would first talk to people. Look for people in your network that have taken that break. And I would do two things. One of them was I would just invite them for a coffee. Like, hey, I saw you stepped away. Would love to hear how it's going. And the other thing is that I would train myself to react to anybody that I hear, including this person that I'm meeting for coffee, to react to the sentence, I'm taking some time off, with congratulations. To shift a bit the way that we perceive it. Because whatever it is that is going on inside of us, we all have our biases, we all have, you know, our baggage that we carry on, and that applies to work as well. So, you know, the peeling of the layers of whatever your work identity is, that will take some time, and not everybody has to go through it, and that's not a particular piece of advice that I would necessarily push on. But I would say, can you actually shift a bit the way that you react to people when they're taking time off? And can you look for some people who have taken time off? You know, what's the appeal? Can you just listen to somebody's experience and see what that does to you?
I remember when I got my first hate mail, when someone sent me this really mean email, and it shook me a bit, of course. And I remember I sent it to two of my founder friends, and they sent me the exact same completely unexpected response, and that was congratulations. And I was like, what? And they were like, it means that you're doing something that is stirring something in people, like you're doing something that matters when people start to hate on you. And I think there's two answers that I love when someone shares something big. One is simply, thank you for your honesty. You don't need to fix it. You don't need to guide them. You can just be like, thank you for your honesty. Thank you for sharing that with me. And I'm going to add this to my repertoire. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Yeah. And I also, to be honest, I see it quite a bit lately because I've been very vocal. If it wasn't for taking 6 months off, which in that time I decided to start writing a book, which is, you know, such a privilege. Like, who has the time? I know you're writing a book as well. Who can have, you know, full days on end to focus on one project at a time? That is a luxury of our modern times. But also in that time, I had the mental space and also the capacity to spend the time to study, for example, AI, and to study the overlap with sustainability. And I had also the energy to go and talk to people who already were working in, you know, predictive AI and kind of like machine learning and deep learning, and actually ask them the technical questions and be able to understand and go deep into that. Whereas not having that break from work, not having that time to go on tangents, would have literally not allowed me to right now go on stages and talk about sustainable AI. You know, I think that we have to also understand a bit there that whatever the work identity is, sure, that's yours. And there's so much more out there. But I understand that it's uncomfortable. I understand that it's an in-between space. And that maybe you can feel like you're stepping into the unknown. But the beautiful thing about the unknown is that it has a lot of opportunities, a lot of gaps that you can kind of like fill, and a lot of hats that you can try on and see if they fit you or not.
Yeah, and a not-so-secret of the world is that everything is unknown. Like, even if you think the world is not predictable, your path is not predictable, even if you think you have this, like, very secure job and very secure path, nothing is set in stone, nothing is promised tomorrow. So I think if you can accept that actually everything is unknown, it can be kind of liberating.
Yeah, and you can also just try it out, you know, like you can try the hat out. Like, can you take some time off to try something out? Can you experience it through other people? I understand. I hear you. I think it's, I live in Amsterdam. So in my circle, which is also I've had this conversation with a few people in my circle, it is not uncommon for people to work for themselves or to take time off work. And sometimes I forget that it's a bit of a bubble, because also the Netherlands is, in a way, it's organized with a large part of the workforce working as independent contractors. It's a bit of an interesting setup. A lot of people work part-time for a variety of reasons. So in a lot of ways, it's actually the perfect bedrock for generalists, if I can say that. But it's something else that I notice. I'm originally Romanian, so when I go and I visit my family, it is the reaction to not being in a very stable work situation, because culturally that is very important. The reaction to that is a bit of panic, a bit of fear, a bit of what are you going to do now? So I think that there's space here that we can hold also for the cultural complexity that comes with what work stability means, what work identity means, and how do they come together in us depending on where we live and kind of what we're exposed to.
I really appreciate you naming that. There's listeners from all over the world, so I think it's a really important point. I also would be amiss if I didn't pick your brain a little bit more on the sustainability intersection of AI. I know you've spent a lot of time thinking, researching, reading, and to question your own question earlier, can AI be sustainable?
It can be more sustainable than the big options that we're currently using. So in a nutshell, generative AI cannot really have any positive impact on climate goals, planetary boundaries, climate work itself. It's consumes a lot of resources. It can improve, sure, our output in terms of work. But if we simply look at the energy consumption, the water consumption, and the way that it's being applied, right, in large language models, that is not a thing. However, the work that is being done using predictive AI, using deep learning, using machine learning, those applications for climate solutions are actually impressive. And that's where more capital should be going in. So I'm thinking right now of an example of a place, I think it was in India, that was really struggling with drought, and with a mix of predictive AI and some, I think it was some machine learning as well, they basically were able to take some satellite data to take the information on the precipitation, so the rain that has had fallen in the last few years, and help the farmers in the area to basically know when to irrigate to get the best crop results, which, you know, that helps not only on a subsistence perspective, but also it helps the soil because it doesn't lose its capacity of holding the crops to such a large extent. Or one of my favorite applications is a solution that is used in the Amazon, where they basically used AI on brick phones to put them in the Amazon. So then the AI could actually listen to both animal noises, but also logging noises. So then when they would hear logging noises and they would actually pinpoint it, they would be able to send rangers or the police for the illegal deforestation that would happen there. And those are not generative AI applications, right? So in that way, you know, if you do use a lot of Gen AI, and I do, like I'm very upfront, I even disclose it on my LinkedIn post when I use AI to create my posts, can you have less of an impact? Yeah, for sure. You know, you can shift to a smaller model, right? You can shift from one of the big AI solutions to a smaller one. And I'm not paid by anybody, but if anybody wants a solution, I'm happy to give you a few suggestions. There is something that's called a small model revolution, and that helps because you basically use a smaller model that is trained on less parameters. Therefore, it uses less computational power. So when you kind of send something out in, you know, ChatGPT, it cross-references and it goes around billions and billions of parameters, but maybe you're just asking for a recipe for dinner. So maybe we don't need to use all of that power for that. But also you can use more specific models, right? So I recently started working and trying out a model that is basically trained just on climate, which I find very useful as well. But then, of course, the answers are going to be so much more accurate, less hallucinations, because it has to guess less. And then I'll close here because I know it's also a lot of information for maybe people that are just getting into the subject. Two things that you can do, you know, right after this episode is that you can batch your prompts. So that is, you know, when you kind of go and you say, make the slide green. Now it gives you the slide. And then you ask it, can you make this font larger? And then it makes the font larger. And then you say, actually, I want the background to be orange. That you're basically powering up, you can think of it as powering up a really powerful engine every single time with every prompt. So it consumes a lot of energy. So it's really worthwhile, and I know it takes a little bit of time to getting used to it, it's really worthwhile to take the extra 5 minutes and kind of think of the prompt and put all of those requests together. And that basically you fire up the engine once instead of 10 times in a row. And the other thing that could also be applied right away is that you can be as concise as possible. So when you go to your LLM of choice, you know, don't tell it a variety of vague things. Hi, this is how my day was. I'm feeling like this. I want to get this project done, but I don't know where to start. I don't really know what to do with it. I think I want something modern looking. Take the time and think, how concise can you be about it? Because then you eliminate the guesswork, and the less it has to guess, the less power it uses.
They are such fantastic tips. I have never heard of just like compressing your prompts into one. And I loved that you made it really concrete for non-technical people as well to be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Revving up the car. That's really helpful. Where do you think this is all going? Like with your perspective of where you are, AI, sustainability, what's your predictions? Where is the world of work heading in the next few months or years?
I think we're gonna dilly-dally for a bit longer, what I've noticed, because I talk to a lot of people on a daily basis, I notice that people are kind of stuck in a bit of a rock and a hard place. There we go. And that's because on one hand, there's like, as you said in the beginning, you know, there's this huge pressure. Get on AI, you know, AI or die. I see it in companies that I work with as well, you know. Get on board, it's time, we're behind, our competitors are doing it. And then we have the individual level, which is, I have the full-time job. When in the world am I gonna understand how this works? Why would I apply it to my job? Will I be out of a job, right? So I think that there's a lot of space there and a lot of conflict internally in organizations that we're not potentially ready to talk about yet, because it raises questions that a lot of companies don't have answers to. I personally would, that's what I'm watching that space of tension, right? What is the ethical responsibility that an organization should take when they go to their workforce and they say, listen, everything that you use, you should be using AI, increase your productivity, and then they drop them into the ether and they say, okay, good luck. How is the workforce reacting to that, right? So I think that's a tension point that is going to get stronger and stronger. I think it will create ups and downs and adoption in that way. I think something else is going to happen, and I am now kind of just shifting at the sustainability space. That is a bit of a reluctant audience at the moment. We have some data that shows that sustainability professionals are not interested and they don't have a lot of plans to start using AI. I think the pressure there is going to increase and they will be getting on board, but I think it will be more like malicious compliance type of approach. So that's another space that I'm watching, because there's also, like, of course, the environmental aspect to using AI and how does it affect my sustainability goals. So I'm curious to see how that's going to go. And the third thing, and I'll close with this, is the small model revolution. I think we're going to see more and more small, ethical, sovereign models and solutions. I think for Europeans, we're going to see a shift from big AI tech that's mostly American-based to European-based solutions. I hear more and more conversations about sovereign AI, and I see kind of the European AI Act is coming up more in conversation. So I expect that kind of the sovereignty and the small model revolution, I think those are going to meet more to bring, smaller but also less hungry models to the market.
And what do you mean by sovereign AI?
That is a question that we're trying to answer for some time. But in a larger sense of the word, it's basically when you rely less on external players in the AI force, in the AI field, and you rely more on either national or kind of European connecting sources. So for example, the Netherlands has come up and they've created their own GPT, which is called NLGPT, I believe, or GPT-NL, one of the two. And they did it with an interesting angle. It's trained on the Dutch language because that's where they wanted to keep the attention on. Because with, English trained languages, you miss the nuance, the cultural nuance, which I think is quite interesting. But also because they wanted to be more self-reliant, right? So they wanted the data to be owned by themselves, and they wanted to be less exposed to the ups and downs of what is happening in AI as a field outside of the country. So I find that very interesting. So there's a bunch of entities that came together, developed that as a solution, and they're now kind of trying to see, okay, where do we want to use it and how is that important for us? And then, of course, the big conversation that is happening right now is, on data privacy and security.
Today feels like a school day for me. I feel like this episode has given me so many things to think about and research more. And particularly, I'm so interested and fascinated by how these AI models are essentially going to become more specialized, because I've been like preaching that as AI develops, generalists using AI, and I mean, I'm just using Claude, and that is obviously a very general model. However, it is incredible because I do feel like I've got these specialists in my pocket, and I'm like, imagine when you actually have generalists working with these highly specialized models. Wow. Wowee.
Yeah. There was an interesting conversation I was a part of a couple of days ago on this topic. A lot of knowledge workers are now feeling the pressure of everybody can be a knowledge worker nowadays with the use of AI. Which, depending on what part of the conversation you're on, it can be an opportunity or it can be a threat, right? But of course, that covers kind of the layer of the know-how itself. But what generalists are particularly good at is kind of bringing those threads together, right? So kind of taking the patterns that you've seen, the patterns that I've seen in sustainability, and bringing those now into AI through the ESG lens, which stands for environmental, social, and governance. That can be done because I can bring these two chapters together, right? Mm-hmm. And it can be done even better with AI because I don't have to do that much manual work, for example. So I think in that way, generalists are going to thrive. But I am personally very aware of this plate that never gets empty, actually. Because I think our capacity to go maybe wide in a variety of topics and finding those patterns, I think that can be kind of crowded by how fast we can go nowadays. So personally, I'm a big advocate of making sure that the processing time of whatever topics you're bringing together or whatever solution you're bringing to the market, the time to process that stays as sacred as possible, because it can be really juicy to stay super extra busy all the time, you know, because you can kind of like bring everything together.
Oh, this is a fantastic episode. I'm loving it. I wonder, could you tell me the grocery shop story?
Ah, the LinkedIn thing. I'm still kind of, it's in my back pocket for dinner parties. So I have been on LinkedIn kind of like working on my personal brand for, I would say, a little under a year. And I started very much looking for my voice. Like, I'm somebody who has always written. I'm writing a book right now. So writing comes easily to me. But I wanted to kind of figure out where I want to position myself. So I've been trying, you know, to see where I feel comfortable and what stance. I was looking for the stances that I want to develop. And because I have this background of kind of travel, comms, strategy, sustainability, and now AI, you know, people know me for a part of that, right? Because they only can see that much through my posts. So I was doing my grocery shopping and I was wearing, you know, my big headphones. So that was a very functional grocery shopping trip. It was not a social one. And this man came up to me and kind of like touched me on the back and said, "Hi, you know, are you Madalena from LinkedIn?" To which I thought, obviously, okay, this is somebody that I worked with, or somebody maybe that I was introduced to, or maybe we've been in some sort of connection. So, you know, I reacted with, "Yes, how did we work together? How have we met?" Which was already, I was smiling because I thought, how cool for somebody to just recognize you in a grocery shop. To which he said, basically, "No, you don't know me. We have somebody in common that we used to work at the same company as you, but you never worked with him either. But I follow you on LinkedIn and I wanted to come up and say, hey, I really like what you're posting. I think it's very cool. Your points of view are quite interesting. And I wanted to say, keep doing it because I'm learning a lot from you." And then he walked away. And I thought, all right, well, that made my evening. Thank you.
Wow. I've had similar things happen and it's kind of like hilarious and odd and amazing all at the same time, because it's this like kind of parasocial relationship where people start to feel like they know you. And in a way they do, because they know your knowledge and your perspectives and your takes. But it's always so funny when the in-person and online worlds like collide. I love that for you. Is there anything that you, so you're about a year into your building your personal brand, is there anything you would go back and tell Mada at the beginning of that journey of maybe what you would do differently?
Think less. I remember I thought I had to have, no, I think way less right now about it. I remember I thought I have to have very strong, very kind of organized points of view. And then I was thinking kind of with an essay mind, but LinkedIn is not for essays. So while I didn't spend a lot of time writing my posts, I would only post when I felt like my point of view was very strong. Like I didn't want to, you know, dilly-dally. I didn't want to be confusing in any way. I would go back and I would say, post whatever your interest is about. And if it's confusing, people will tell you it's confusing. And if it flops, it flops. And if it doesn't, then yeah, you have something to go on. But yeah, think less. It's not supposed to take up a lot of your headspace, to be honest.
Yeah, plus one. Yeah. I think people get really caught up on wanting to have this perfect like 15-step plan and system and like repurposing. And I'm like, just post what you find interesting and be honest. That's it.
Yeah, same. And I think that's why your post also stood out to me before I joined the generalist world. I was like, oh, this girl posts like she's speaking to me, which is exactly how I post as well and how I write as well. So I was like, oh, yeah, that's human. I want to hear more of that.
I appreciate that. Well, we will, of course, include your links in the show notes so people can go and see and connect with you. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wish I had asked you while you've got the mic?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to pop in and talk about my book. I'm writing a book that is called The Tired Overachiever. I'm almost done with it. It is a sarcastic self-help book where I write about 10 global challenges for millennials and Gen Z. So I write about climate change anxiety, life-work balance, economic instability and job volatility, sustainable AI, access to healthcare, access to education, and a few other topics. I am running a short survey where I ask people, especially non-Western voices, you know, how do they rate and rank these global challenges that I'm writing about? Because I want to bring more human voices in the conversation outside of the big kind of the Deloitte surveys of the world. So that would be great if people feel like answering to that. And I am looking for two more people to interview for the book. So for two topics that I still have going on. So if anybody's feeling kind of like, oh, that sounds interesting, I want to be interviewed, tell me more, please send me a message and we'll see if it's a good match.
That was a mic drop ending. I love the confidence and kudos, because it's a labor of love, the book. People always say this, and then you get in it and you're like, oh yeah, it's a long, very personal process. So I cannot wait to read and share it. We will add the survey link in the show notes.
Same for yours. I love how also, like, I really appreciated how you kind of were like, I was writing a book and it wasn't my type of book, and now I'm rewriting this thing in a way that fits me. So I look forward to being able to say, hey, I know this person who wrote this cool book about being a generalist.
Thank you. It was actually funny. Last night, my husband came home and he had like print. I sent him like the draft a while ago and then kind of forgot about it. And he had printed it off and he's reading it. And it gave me a moment of like, oh yeah, people are actually hopefully going to read this and to see it actually in print rather than on a screen. Maybe you already have, but it's a real moment. Printing it.
It's absolutely. If you want, I have one last, it's not even a suggestion. It's just kind of like sharing how I had people reading my chapters. So I told you that I kind of run interviews for each of the chapters of the book. So what I did is that I printed one chapter that was ready, one chapter at a time, and I brought it to the person that I interviewed on that particular topic. And then I sat there next to them while they read the book. Because the idea of having my book out in the wild already for people to read and kind of like have it laying around on their table, on their dining table, that felt like too much of a big step. So instead, I bought them a coffee and I sat there and I stared at them to see, you know, to get, I wanted warm feedback. I wanted to see, do they laugh? Do they not laugh? Do they frown? And of course, then they would give me the feedback. But getting that kind of somatic experience, that was super valuable. I really enjoyed it.
I couldn't love that anymore. So good. Yeah. So good.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for being a part of GW. And I can't wait to share this episode.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.